One of the biggest, baddest, and certainly most stylish of Disney villains is getting an origin story. In Cruella, Emma Stone plays young Estella, an orphan on the streets of London in the 1970s. She's a thief with an eye for fashion, whose life fatefully intertwines with imperious fashion designer the Baroness, played with icy hauteur by Emma Thompson.
Their relationship is both a mentorship and rivalry, as Estella secretly adopts the masked identity of Cruella, an avant-garde designer, for Disney anyway, and vigilante, sort of. Anyway, she's out for revenge. I'm Aisha Harris.
And I'm Glenn Weldon, and today we're talking about Cruella on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me and Aisha is Letitia Harris. She is an NPR music contributor and an editorial assistant for the great NPR podcast Louder Than a Riot. Welcome back, Letitia.
Hi, Glenn. Thank you so much. Hi, Aisha.
And also with us from her home in Washington, D.C. is NPR music contributor Serena Toros. Hey, Serena.
Hey, Glenn, what's up?
Not much. When we meet young Estella, she's a girl with black and white hair having a rough time at school. Through a series of events, she finds herself alone on the streets of London, joining two other ne'er-do-wells, Jasper and Horace, played by Joel Fry and Paul Walter Hauser, in a life of petty crime. One day she meets Emma Thompson's Baroness, who grudgingly takes Estella under her wing as an assistant designer. But by night, Estella, as the masked designer Cruella, stages elaborate stunts designed to humiliate the Baroness as secrets come to light that drive her toward vengeance. The pedigree of this movie is impressive. It's directed by Craig Gillespie of I, Tonya and Lars and the Real Girl. The screenplay was co-written by Dana Fox and Tony McNamara. Now, McNamara co-wrote The Favorite and The Great, which we've talked about on this show. The story is by Aileen Brosh McKenna, among others. McKenna co-created Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, of course. And this will come as no surprise once you've seen this movie. She also wrote the screenplay for The Devil Wears Prada. Cruella is out in theaters and available to stream on Disney Plus for $30 right now. Serena, I have it on good authority that growing up, 101 Dalmatians, the animated film, was your favorite Disney film. Is that correct?
I mean, how do you tell someone that you're gay without telling them that you're gay? I mean, you liked all of the animal films from Disney.
Here's what I love about that. It's bold. It's iconoclastic. And if that's the hill you're going to die on, there's not going to be too many other corpses on that hill, I think. So that's fascinating. This is why I want to start with you. What'd you think of Cruella?
I had mixed feelings going into it. I am not a big fan of Disney's recent push for live-action remakes, but I did want to give it the benefit of the doubt. I think this movie works best when it's in Devil Wears Prada mode, when it's like a workplace comedy, when it's about the bad boss, when it's, you know, these glamorous set designs and dresses and gowns. And I think this movie loses me when it gets bogged down trying to explain her tragic little orphan tale. I think it's the exact wrong combination of emphasizing the tropey parts of that and glossing over the trauma that would make it interesting. I was rooting for Estella and not Cruella, and I think that's a problem. I feel like you don't need to be able to root for your protagonist in a villain story, but I do think you need to be able to see where they're coming from, and the emotional beats here were just a bit too rote for me to do that. And as much as I think Emma Stone was fun in this role, I think a lot of the character's decisions make more sense to me when you realize she's supposed to be around 18 years old. I mean, just like think of The Rage and the new Olivia Rodrigo album that just came out. Like, that's an 18-year-old. And I think actually casting somebody who was closer in age, maybe like 18, 19, 20 years old, would have gone a long way in fixing some of these like logical, emotional problems for me. But like, this is the problem, right? Like when you make your whole vehicle for your villain and I find those parts the most uninteresting, I definitely found the new material the most compelling, and the fact that I'm taken out of it when it's supposed to be relating to the source material just kind of makes this movie like not super work for me.
Interesting. I picked up on some of the same things in terms of this film working kind of cross purposes to itself. When it softens the Cruella character, it's doing it in kind of different ways, which don't quite cohere. But Letitia, what'd you make of Cruella?
I do not know where to start. Serena and I are different people in that I am the person that Disney makes all the live action remakes for. I love them. I eat them up. So I really wanted to love this movie. But Cruella doesn't know like whether it wants to be Mean Girls, The Devil Wears Prada, Ocean's 8, or Annie. And it's so predictable. It lacks charisma and comedy. You know, I was always laughing at it and never with it. I think I laughed with it like maybe one time. And I was disappointed by a lot of it, you know, the editing, the pacing, the costuming, and the soundtrack, but especially the writing. Like, I think the Baroness deserved way better barbs. Whoever was writing her little drags needed a little lesson about how to do that, I think. But I think most of all, like, this movie just bastardizes the lore behind queer icon Cruella de Vil and turns her into a white feminist with a split personality, which I think is offensive, truly, feels very ableist. And what really, really stings, honestly, is that the way the movie treats blackness and regards blackness is really disappointing to me. And I want to say to, you know, every black actor in Disney's Cruella, I saw you and value each one of your excellent performances as more than a diversity quota, even if the movie you're casted in did not, perhaps.
Okay, that is that's a scorched earth take. Aisha, will anything grow in the space again, or is there more scorching to happen?
Oh, I love what both Serena and Letitia had to say about this. While watching this, I had to force myself to ask the question of which I think is worse, Disney's live-action remakes or the Disney prequel origin story remakes they've come out with. And, you know, there's pluses and minuses to both. The origin story, at least you're getting something new. It doesn't feel like a shot-for-shot remake like the... the creatively bankrupt Lion King or Aladdin, both of which were
Beauty and the Beast.
Beauty and the Beast. Ugh, goodness. Let's throw in some like feminism layers on top of those just to fix the things that we should have done the first time around. Yes. But then the thing with this origin story and the problem with many of these origin stories, especially when it comes to villains, because usually those are the origin stories we get lately anyway, is that they suggest that in order to become a villain, you have to have a villain in your life before you become a villain. And so my thing is, what if the villain is just awful? They were just born this way. And that is what happened. And I don't need all this Freudian, my mother, my father, my whoever screwed me over or something bad happened to me as a child. All of that just feels so contrived and really frustrating. And I can't believe I'm going to pull out the Underground Railroad here in comparison. But I just watch it and it's fresh on my mind. And what I liked about both Colson Whitehead's book and then Barry Jenkins' adaptation of it for Amazon is that the villain in that, Joel Edgerton's Ridgeway, who's the slave catcher, does not have those issues. In fact, his father is trying to do good and he just turns bad. And I like that inverse and the way we see something like that happen where actually maybe you could have come from a good home. Maybe you could have like had all the right things in your life and yet you still became terrible. And that to me would be way more interesting than what we get here. I don't think Emma Stone, you know, it's interesting to watch her and also think about someone like Anne Hathaway, who's obviously started off as the ingenue and now is trying to become more weird and take on more quote unquote sort of wacky flamboyant roles as they've aged into their 30s. And, you know, Anne Hathaway played the witch, the Grand High Witch and the witches, and she was going to the hilt, and Emma Stone is also going to the hilt.
No, the necklace. One of the Dalmatians ate it. Not sure which one, so you'll need to kidnap all of them.
All right, sorry, slow down. What do we...
Darling, if I'm going to need to repeat myself a lot, this isn't going to work out.
It didn't really work for me. I agree that she was way too old to be playing this role. At one point in the movie, they say 10 years have passed, and she's supposed to be maybe 21, 22, according to the timeline of the film, and Emma Stone looks like the age she is. And I'm the same age as Emma Stone, so this is no shade. I'm just saying. It's very frustrating. So would not recommend it. Also, it's way too long.
It is way too long.
Yeah, it's 2.5 hours long. It's also $30. Do I like this movie $30? Worth? No. But, I mean, this doesn't happen often, but my takes are similar to y'all's, but they're less strong. So I comparatively come off seeming like Little Mary Sunshine, I think, here, which is not... It's not a comfortable place for me. It's kind of messing with my identity. But when this movie is The Devil Wears Pongo, I am totally in.
You can't care about anyone else. Everyone else is an obstacle. You care what an obstacle wants or feels, you're dead. If I'd cared about anyone or thing, I might have died like so many brilliant women, with a drawer full of unseen genius and a heart full of sad bitterness. You have the talent for your own label. Whether you have the killer instinct is the big question.
I can't hate that. Who am I? I can't hate that. You've got exactly the same central dynamic as The Devil Wears Prada. You've got the bald assistant in dark clothes. You've got Mark Strong versus Stanley Tucci. I went into this thing absolutely cold, and about half an hour in, I was compelled to check the credits because what I was watching didn't conform to what I've come to expect from Disney live-action films, which is not much. Here's what I think the secret is. If you're going to do this, you got to do it with Emma Thompson. She is so much fun. She is not doing broad pantomime here, which was really all the role calls for. She could just mug her way through this thing in her sleep, but she is creating a very specific characters with layers who is also a monster. both those things can be true. The film doesn't permit Emma Stone's character to do the same thing, though she certainly could. I mean, like, this is... Emma Stone could do it. It's just there's a flaw in the way the screenplay treats her character. Because, again, Emma Stone's always great. I'm in the tank for Emma Stone. She gets to swan around London and knock off Vivian Westwood's, and that'll always be the dream. But this was too long. But, again, I can even almost argue my way out of that. If you're going to spend $30 and they've put all this work in production and costume design, you want to spend some time with it. But ultimately, the film doesn't know what to do with Estella Cruella. As Letitia, as you mentioned, they're playing with notions of dissociative identity disorder in a way that really seems undercooked and outdated. They're dealing with it the way soap operas would play it. It just seems a little cheap, like not enough thought has gone into it. But my main point is that they are softening certain aspects of this character with regard to, say, animal cruelty, but they're not softening the other comic element, which is how much she mistreats her goons, her friends. Those two impulses are working across purposes. If you're going to soften one thing, you got to soften the other if you're trying to make this a three-dimensional character and not just a literally cartoon Disney villain. That softening meant that the film didn't kind of know where to go at certain places with her character.
I totally agree. I think Cruella tries really hard to be feminist and garner empathy for the, you know, villain, but it's like sometimes feminism is about letting women be dynamic thieves and bitches and killing dogs, truthfully. Like, she wants to do it in 101 Dalmatians. Let her do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, I was wondering if that was a spoiler to say, like, no dogs are actually harmed in the making of this movie. Like,
oh,
and that to me is a travesty because that is her identity. She does not care. She will kill those dogs to make the coat that she wants. And the fact that they don't do that and that she uses, I guess, fake fur or like colored fur is just, what?
Yeah.
Cruella would never use fake fur. Look at her.
What? Yeah, I know. Now, let's talk about the needle drops, which have garnered some spicy takes in the preparation document for this episode. I liked them. I hated all the needle drops in Army of the Dead because they were so on the nose. These are just on the nose in trying to capture and, you know, evoke 70s London. But I really like that music, so I guess it didn't bother me that much, but it really bothered y'all, right?
There were 800 of them.
Too many.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It was so overwhelming. And also, to hear Nina Simone in this movie, I know she's already been used to death in the worst ways possible, in every commercial way possible, but especially to see it being used in a scene where young Estella arrives for her first day for working with a baroness, and the song is Feeling Good, and I'm just like, Nina Simone is rolling over several times, over.
Let's touch the third rail here about the marketing of this movie in the promotional copy as the punk rock origin story of Cruella.
Yeah.
And I think the needle drops here do that very silly premise a disservice if they're trying to create that world. Because, yes, these are songs from the 70s, but these aren't punk songs. There was one punk song, which I don't know if it's a spoiler to say, is used in a big high fashion show moment, and it's a Stooges song. I think you can guess what it is. And it's like way overproduced. I was like, you took the one punk song in this film and you did the opposite of what punk is and you overproduced it. The weird message of, you know, Emma Stone's character being punk and Emma Stone's character being feminist fail on a lot of levels. Sure, you can maybe argue that she's trying to be anti-establishment and that there's some overlap there with punk ideals, but like having beef with one person isn't anti-establishment.
I don't know. I mean, I didn't see anybody in the film throwing around the word punk. Obviously, the Baroness's effect is kind of vague, sort of knockoff Vivian Westwood, sure. But, like, I didn't see anybody in the film. That's all over the marketing copy. You're exactly right, Serena. That is all over the marketing copy for this thing. I just didn't see that in the film too much. I just said 70s to me in a bigger way. But I take your point. I take your point. It's interesting.
I think there's nothing punk about this film. I think Emma Stone just wears black and she's a little mean. Like, she aspires to be the establishment. She literally says to the Baroness, I want to be you. I want your power. I want all these things. Like, her goal isn't to take it down. Her goal is to take down the Baroness, and the Baroness just represents the thing she wants to aspire to. Like, I just think she's not punk whatsoever. And I think it's a very far reach for the promotional company to say that.
Well, right. To play Cruella's devil's advocate.
To play DeVille's advocate?
DeVille's advocate.
Yes. Cruella DeVille's advocate. You could argue that this is about the fashion world. And the fashion world, anytime it tries to do anything that is anti-establishment or tries to evoke that, whether it's like some famous high designer is going to do like punk as the aesthetic or like Black Panther as the aesthetic,
it's always called out for being, this is just the fashion industry's version of that, and there's no way that like anyone actually is buying this. So we could argue that that is like Disney, that could be what they're thinking. It's probably not, because Disney also does the same thing. I can kind of see the aesthetic in that sense of the, it not necessarily meant to be punk, but to evoke the fashion industry's version of punk.
Punk adjacent. All right. Well, we got a range of negative reactions to this film. Tell us what you think about Cruella. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it will be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Vrbo. Your family reunion is more important than ever. That's why Vrbo has private, whole vacation homes for the whole family, and just the family, no shared room or spaces. So whether it's around the pool, grill, or patio, your family will have the space and privacy to finally reconnect. Download the Vrbo app. The time for getting back together is now. Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Blue Moon. When you need some extra brightness, Blue Moon is here to help you break from the everyday. Blue Moon gives a refreshing take on a Belgian-style wheat ale with Valencia orange and coriander for a one-of-a-kind flavor and appearance. And try the new Blue Moon Light Sky, brewed with tangerine peel. Get them delivered at get.bluemoonbeer.com. Blue Moon. Taste brightness. Celebrate responsibly. Blue Moon Brewing. Golden, Colorado. Ale.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? Serena, let's start with you. What is making you happy this week?
Sure. So I've seen these like little drawings pop up in places I hang out on the internet by an artist called Cat Crumb, like C-A-T-C-R-U-N-B. They're just like these little daily doodles by this anonymous artist, and they create them in Microsoft Paint, and they run the gamut between cute little supportive kittens, like offering their friend a muffin, or little motivational speeches for maybe students who are struggling in Zoom University, or just like feral cats. Like one of my favorites, the cat says, like, I am not your little jester, I am my own little jester. So they're very simple, very cute line art doodles that I highly recommend. And Cat Crumb is on Tumblr and Instagram.
Cat Crumb. Thank you so much, Serena. Letitia, what is making you happy this week?
So I actually have been devastated by the terrible Cruella movie. So I've been leaning into some older comforts. I am really happy for the fantastic illustrator Harriet. They are on Twitter and Tumblr. And for anyone who is seeking good Cruella origin content, she has built this really great world about Cruella in like college and like post-college life and what that could look like in a more realistic way. And she's also a big proponent of Cruella and Anita being together, you know, ideal situation. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's been making me very, very happy. And I just wish she was in the convo when Disney decided to make this movie.
That's the illustrator Harriet. What is her Twitter tag?
So you can find Harriet on Twitter at Hatters Arts.
Thank you very much, Letitia. Aisha Harris, what is making you happy this week?
Well, by this Friday night, all 6 episodes of the second season of A Black Lady Sketch Show will have dropped on HBO. And this show just makes me so happy. I loved the first season. I think the season is even better. The women of the show, which this season, the main ensemble consists of Robin Thede, Ashley Nicole Black, Gabrielle Dennis, Lacey Mosley, and Skye Townsend. And I feel like they've really found their groove, and there are just some really fun sketches. One of my favorites this season has been the overly supportive friend who is played by Ashley Nicole Black in that scene. And in a similar vein of many comedy sketch shows, especially something like Key and Peele, the things just keep ratcheting up until it gets really, really ridiculous and something really crazy happens. And I love the way they're just able to take both Blackness and femininity, and then sometimes not even focus on those things, but just make a really funny, culturally specific sketch out of a joke. It's just really fun. I highly recommend it. There's a lot of great cameos too, including Issa Rae, Jesse Williams, and Gabrielle Union. And that's A Black Lady Sketch Show season 2 on HBO.
Thank you, Aisha. That is an excellent pick. I heartily second it. For me, what is making me happy this week? Hitchhiker is a new indie game I played on PS4. It calls itself a mystery game, but it's bit more abstract than that. You are this hitchhiker who has amnesia. You take a series of rides and you talk to different drivers along the way to try to get clues to your past and figure out what happened to someone you knew who seems to have gone missing. The drivers know a lot more than they're telling you. The radio sometimes gives you these cryptic warnings if you tune it just right. And when you're at a diner, the ketchup and mustard start to float away unless you stare at them directly. So it's very stylized and very dreamlike. And it's wearing its indie status, you know, on its sleeve. But there is a very significant and singular low-level sense of dread you get playing this game. It's like what you recall from dreams, like when you know you've done something wrong, but you don't know what. I'm not entirely sure it sticks the landing narratively because it is so abstract and dreamlike, but I have been thinking about certain images from this game and certain choices I made that I probably shouldn't have made ever since I finished it. So that's Hitchhiker, available on several platforms. I played it on PS4. And that is what is making me happy this week. One last thing before we go. We're going to be talking about the series Friends. Heard of it? And we want to know who you think was the best friend and who was the worst friend. We also want to know who your favorite secondary or tertiary characters are from the Friends cinematic universe. That's Gunther, Ursula, is it Ugly Naked Guy, etc., etc. You can vote now at npr.org/friends. Again, you can vote at npr.org/friends. That brings us to the end of our show. You can find us all on Twitter. You can find me at G.H. Weldon. You can follow Aisha at Crafting My Style. You can follow Letitia at Letitia_E. Harris. And you can follow Serena at Serena Toros. That's C-Y-E-R-E-N-A Toros. You can follow editor Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy and producer Candace Lim at The Candace Lim. You can follow producer Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band Hello Come In provides the music you may or may not be bobbing your head to right now. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Glenn.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR, and we will see you all next week.
An officer pins a 16-year-old to the ground and punches out his teeth. But are there any consequences for the cop? For the first time, we take you inside the secret investigations that show how police protections in California shield officers from accountability. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.